From the Sky News Centre at 6, three people have been killed after a shooting and supermarket hostage-taking in the south of France. 16 people were injured in the attack in Trèbes before the gunman was shot dead. An officer who swapped himself for a hostage is now in a critical condition. French security analyst Anne Giudicelli says the gunman seems to fit the profile of recent European attackers.
The profile in France, even in UK, is the same story. I mean, usually they have a past of petty crime, even prison or things like that.
Two lorry drivers have been jailed for their roles in a crash in August last year that resulted in the deaths of eight people on the M1 in Buckinghamshire. Their minibus got crushed between their two lorries. A police inspector who strangled his detective constable wife and dumped her body in a lake has been convicted of her murder. 43-year-old Darren Mackay from Wilmslow admitted manslaughter just before he was due to give evidence. But today the jury found him guilty of murdering Leanne last September. Rachel Barber is from the Crown Prosecution Service.
Darren Mackay went behind his wife's back to apply for loans in her name, and when she confronted him, he murdered her. Having admitted killing his wife during the trial, Mackay stated he'd not intended to cause her really serious harm or take her life. The weight of evidence showed this to be another lie.
European leaders have thrown their support behind the UK, saying they're set to take further steps to punish Russia over the nerve agent attack in Salisbury. Latvia and the Czech Republic are likely to expel Russian diplomats. Meanwhile, Theresa May claims there's now a new dynamic in the Brexit negotiations after the European Union cleared the way for trade talks with the United Kingdom to begin. And in sport, just quickly, the Republic of Ireland are taking on Turkey in an international friendly this evening. It's still goalless in the first half in Antalya. Later, England face the Netherlands in Amsterdam, and it's Alex McLeish's first game back as Scotland manager. They're hosting Costa Rica. That's the latest. I'm Simon English.
This is Bristol. Friday at 6 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. And Cotton councillor for the Lib Dems, Anthony Negus. After the 7 o'clock news, Trump names John Bolton, who's vowed to attack Iran, Russia and North Korea, and has been seen as the most hawkish on the list to replace General H.R. McMaster as his national security adviser. Bolton's openly advocated the US attacking all those countries, North Korea too, and will be looking to use all sorts of ruses to get war going in Eastern Europe, the Middle East and Korea. Meanwhile, at the CIA, Gina Haspel's about to take over as the first female CIA director, but she's been in charge of torture operations. So this is a victory for women's rights or not? Also, a look at the latest government conspiracy theories as Salisbury's Sergei Skripal fairy tale unfolds. We ask, too, why fundamental flaws in the story aren't being questioned by the London media. 8 months in jail for teenager Ahed Tamimi for slapping an Israeli soldier who was occupying her district. In her home. And a little bit of England surrounded by China. An exclusive interview with long-time Hong Kong-based journalist David O'Rear, who I spoke to last month about the tense East-West standoff in Hong Kong. The theory is we still have 40 years to run of a transition agreement where Hong Kong keeps its own legal system, currency and police. But China gradually is taking control. Plus, some of the other news and corporate media have either spun or ignored. That's all in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 5 Celsius and some rain this weekend, highs of 11 Celsius, light rain and breezy this weekend. Tomorrow, sunny spells and breezy on Sunday. Next week, highs around 11 still, some sunny spells, showers and again, windy, breezy. Next weekend, that's Easter weekend. That's the 31st and the 1st of April. 31st of March and the 1st of April. Temperature as high as around 10, so about the same. Showers and sunny spells. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. And if you wonder if we are going to be here next Good Friday, yes, we certainly are, for our 10th anniversary programme. It's literally 10 years of Fridays. We've been nagging you on the airwaves. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, let's just have a little look at the Bristol Arena. I know it's not a subject you're 100% up to speed on, mm-hmm. but there's been some decision this week, a vote finally, that it's actually going to be in the city, not up in Filton. I mean, do you think that, what is the point of the arena to begin with, and what are your thoughts about whether we really need to be spending money on this or not?
Well, I haven't got strong opinions about this because I know that there's been lots of discussion at the City Council going on for years and years and years. Personally, the arena doesn't mean a lot to me. The kind of bands and events that would come to it would not be the sort of thing I'd go to see. And therefore, I'm not really the best person to ask about whether it's a good idea or not.
Well, I'll tell you who I think the best person in the city, or one of them anyway, to ask is, and that's Councillor Anthony Negus, who's joining us on the phone. Hi, Anthony. Welcome to the Politics Show. Could you just give us a bit of the background of why we actually need an arena?
Well, back in the early part of the of this century, back in about 2008, it was decided that Bristol was one of the last cities without an arena. It's a very important part of our offer. To attract visitors and to complete the package, the cultural package in Bristol. So we started then to put in train options for how this could be done, and pretty well got all of that sorted out by about 2012.
I mean, some people will say, Anthony, that we don't need one. We've already got football stadia, which could be used for that sort of purpose.
We did try it. When Bristol City was moving and looking at a new site at Ashton Vale, we did actually look then at trying to make that a site which would double up as an arena, and in fact also had a site on it which could be used for a conference centre as well. As you know, that site fell over because of the Town and Village Green issues, and now the stadium is back where it was and being refurbished, so that option is no longer available. The site, there aren't that many free sites in Bristol in the right places that are big enough, and indeed the arena site is only suitable for a 12,000 seat arena, whereas some of them are rather bigger, there are 15,000-16,000 now.
Okay, so what is the purpose? What is the sort of activities that will go on there that really mean that Bristol City Council should be involved rather than some private contractor, private developer?
Well, there is a private operator. What is being done is that Bristol City Council have got together with the other local authorities and the what was then the LEP, the Local Enterprise Partnership, that's now suddenly taken over by the West of England group, and that's all of those people with government money and some other money as well made the whole thing viable. And in 2012 we were ready to move forward on that. It pretty well atrophied for the next 2 or 3 years, and I think that Mayor Ferguson was very, very keen to have at least a shovel in. Well, he was very keen to have it built by the time he came up for re-election in 2016. He was then reduced that to trying to get a shovel in the ground. Of course, as we all know, that didn't work either. So it all got very, very slowed down. And of course, as the decision making got slower and poorer, the cost went up.
Okay, what about the location then? And just take us through there. I know there was a petition to say it should stay in the city centre or near the city centre rather than be up at Filton. But what were the crux of those arguments?
The arguments, the petitions were very one way, very heavily weighted towards keeping it at Temple Meads. And I think, and I broadly support this, subject to the knowing what the final difference in cost will be. But on the face of it, it would seem that the although the temple quarter site will cost more, it's a cheaper site. There's already a prepared site and a building, as it were, at Filton. It will cost more, but it will provide very much more worthwhile benefits to the city of Bristol and its people. It will mean that it will act as an anchor for development which is happening in St Philip's Marsh, which is part of the broad sweep of our planning proposals for the city of Bristol. That's the way development is going to move now, going from St Philip's Marsh south and east. So this is a very good anchor for that. It's obviously got very good transport infrastructure down at Temple Meads, and it means that jobs and skills, opportunities, benefits, council tax, revenue, all these sorts of things will come into Bristol City rather than going to the very, very edge. I mean, the Filton site is absolutely on the edge of Bristol. If you look out the front door, you're looking at South Gloucester, and that means that there's a very serious problem with the Cripps Causeway and Filton forming a new sort of axis, which will further suck the heart out of Bristol city centre and Cripps and Cabot Circus if that was allowed to go ahead. So the Bristol arena site is much more sustainable in terms of transport than it would be at Filton, which is mainly a road-based operation.
How much are council taxpayers going to be paying towards this?
At the moment, let me go back a quarter of a step and I will answer your question. At the moment, that's a very difficult question to answer because after 2 years of umming and ahhing about this, the current mayor has decided to do some cost some new cost reports on the various options, and he calls them value for money reports. They are not as broad ranging as I would want them to be. I've asked for it several times at Scrutiny Commission that if we're going to do these reports, they need to be much more valuable. And instead of just talking about what this is going to cost and how much more money we'll have to spend to make it work, I want to know, and so should the people of Bristol want to know, the actual value that this will bring to Bristol and the actual benefits that I spoke about before, how that will come in too. We don't appear to have much of that. There's some of that out there, but doesn't seem to be much. So until we know that, we won't know the extra money that Bristol City taxpayers may need to put into this, if indeed they need to put any in at all.
Well, it sounds to me like you're signing a blank cheque.
Until these reports are, these cost reports are in, that's true. But what I feel, and I think many people felt that signed that petition, although I can't speak for them, of course, but it sounded from the people that spoke, I think there's a general feeling that unless the Filton site is massively cheaper, and also that the land at Temple Quarter could be sold for a very large sum of money, if it's not for those things to happen, then still the best site has got to be the Bristol Temple Quarter site for the reasons I gave. But if you ask me what that magic figure is as to when it would be beneficial to go to Filton, I personally think it's a very large number, because I think once the Temple Quarter site, the arena gets built there, the benefits to Bristol will keep on coming for a very long time. And that will be, over time, a very large sum of money.
I come back to the... I mean, you said it's going to be privately operated. Why isn't it being privately paid for if it's such going to be such a commercial success?
Well, that's the way that the money was put together was it started off by being a local authority LEP based financing package. The LEP put, I believe, £5 million into this, and they were very keen to see this come to Bristol to actually create more growth in Bristol, and that's what the local enterprise partnership was set up to do. So this was seen very much as a commercial benefit to the city of Bristol and increase our growth and our income and our visitor numbers. So it was seen as being an opportunity to actually do good for Bristol from Bristol and local government, national government money.
Okay, Anthony. So when is it actually going to start? Do you think we're going to start seeing shovels hit the gravel?
My guess is that we may see out another mayor before that happens, to be perfectly honest. It looks as though a decision is close to being made. And, of course, I'm only a scrutiny councillor. You know, I can only ask questions. I can't make decisions. And the decision, as a matter of interest, just to correct the thing you said right at the beginning, the decision made in full council on Tuesday was only a guide. It was only a steer from council as to how we felt at this stage, with the information we've got right now, which could change, of course. We felt that since the motion was brought, we put our votes with that. But the fact is that recently, and I've been involved in two of them, we've had two things, the libraries motion that I brought, the student mitigation motion that I brought, that actually got a unanimous support from council. Neither of those have been taken forward in the way that those motions asked for by the mayor, so there's no reason at all why anything that this council does or did last Tuesday he will actually respond to.
Okay, I'm going to give you a free rein. Obviously, you're at the full council meeting. Do you want to give us the Lib Dems' view of some of the most important things that happened there?
On Tuesday? Do you mean the full council that's just happened?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, there were quite a few issues that came up. We had we had actually two motions on the paper. One of which was the Temple Meads thing, the arena thing at Temple Meads, as you know. The other one, we had a silver motion about Brexit. That was the Liberal Democrat one, which was agreed to be heard, but in fact Labour and the Conservatives joined up to stop that being heard because it was the end of the day, which is very unfortunate.
Is that filibustering?
I certainly didn't filibuster. We actually wanted to have the vote, and if everyone had sat down and get on with it, we could have had that debate very quickly while they were actually grabbing their coats and making a noise as they're heading for the exit. So that was not one of the council's more glorious moments, I have to say. But the other things that came up, there was a conversation about neighbourhood partnerships and the way that the SIL and Section 106 money are about to be spread very thin around most of this city, and how so-called decisions are going to be made over that, although the decisions now are just asking council very nicely if they would do something for us, rather than doing what neighbourhood partnerships used to do, which was to create for ourselves the things that we felt were most important to our communities and getting them done. That, of course, has all been butchered by this administration. There was also a debate about the rearrangements of small concessionaries in parks, which actually turned out to be a very, very good conversation about how we are to try and make money in our parks to try and keep the parks alive and being so much benefit to Bristol. But at the same time, it meant regularising some of the present arrangements, and we talked about how those arrangements would best be handled to make sure we got the best of a small local concessionaries giving very good quality and service, and yet we were still able to get some income coming into the parks to help them as well. That was actually a very, very good debate that we had in council, and a lot came out of it. I hope the officers, and I certainly hope the mayor and cabinet, listened very closely to that, because there was lots of common sense coming out of it.
I've noticed one of the things up in Fish Ponds Park has been going on is that parts of the park have been leased to farmers to actually use it to make hay with. Is that the sort of thing that the council's looking at now?
The council's looking at, I'm trying to remember how many there were. There was actually a brainstorming session about 8 months ago, 9 months ago, where loads and loads of things were talked about, some of which were quite quite literally off the wall, as it were, not literally, but they were very, very unusual ideas. And from that, and I work on that, to be honest. I think if you're going to do some brainstorming, then you really ought to be thinking about the unthinkable. And then you've got to rationalize that and see where we can find viable things that do actually make money. And if one of our problems, and I don't know about these licenses you're talking about, but if one of our problems is getting rid of grass that just seems to keep growing and doing something with it, then that wouldn't seem to be a particularly mad thing to do, I would have thought.
Well, you end up, though, with the parks with loads and loads of long grass, which isn't really very good for playing games, football, that sort of thing.
Well, we are blessed that Bristol, I think, has something, I mean, I'm sure someone will correct me, it has something like 20% of its the city area is open space. Now, of course, not all of that is parks, but quite a lot of it is green and grassed. And I think there could be some value in trying to find different ways of doing this. Parts of the Downs have been left uncut for quite some time. The Avon Gorge, for example, is grazed by goats. We are talking, and certainly we did when I was in the cabinet, we talked of Stoke Park having cattle back again, so we could actually make some income from the cattle, and of course they graze and keep the grass down and everything else. So there are. I think we've just got to be bolder. I think we've got to look imaginatively at ways that we can make parks. We've got parks that are what you might call our manicured parks, which have got flowers in them, and they're nicely cropped grass, and people play in them. There are other quite large rambling parks. Stoke Park is one, which could be allowed to go back a lot to its original form. And I think that there's a lot of value in that, that people can actually see parks as being rather wilder places, which give opportunity for wildlife, flora and fauna to grab their way back into progress again, rather than just being beaten down every time a great big lawnmower goes over their heads or whatever. So I think there are lots of opportunities out there, and I think we need to keep an open mind.
Now, the Bristol's Labour Mayor, Marvin Rees, has blacklisted this programme. He won't reply now to any of our phone calls, requests, and also twice has pulled out of the last minute without any explanation when he said he was going to come on here. Obviously, you know, that's a bit of a pity. We'd very much like to have him on here discussing things. But what do you make of the way he's running the council these days?
Well, you asked me at the last minute if I would come on this, and I've come on this and I'm talking to you, so I hope that works for you. But I'm not really in the business of slagging people off. I try to think positively about most things. I'm unhappy, to be honest, about the way this council is running. I wouldn't personalise it to an individual, but I think that it's disappointing that that we're not moving forward in a much more visionary way. I think there are lots of things that all of the council, and I think that's what you need to look at. There are 70 councillors there. There are probably something like 500 or 600 major voluntary groups in Bristol, and there are thousands of smaller groups from the rest. I would like us to look very much at trying to get all of those people and finding out what things everyone agrees with doing, and let's get on and do some of those first. Because if not, we're going to just concentrate on the things that are difficult to do and the things that people will find opposition to. I would rather focus on the things that we all believe in going forward on. And there's a massive amount of consensus. You will see what happens in full council. And that's where, like with Prime Minister's Question Time, that's where there's the most spark and the most gripes going on in council. And frankly, confidentially, towards to the thousands of people listening to this programme at the moment, I would tell you most councillors would agree that's the most miserable part of what they do. Where we actually work well and get things done is on committees, when frankly 9 times out of 10 you actually don't think what colour somebody is representing or what their politics are. We're all usually working together to find a common sense solution to finding new ways of doing stuff better. And really, that's when it's good.
Don't you ever feel, Anthony,
that over the in the chamber you might actually be opposing, when you can actually find something that you can work together with people of all ilks, that's when it's good.
Well, but with all these Tory cuts, don't you ever feel like an official receiver slowly closing down a company?
Well, of course. I do still believe that there are ways I do understand the way the cuts have been put through, and the way that there's been a way of trying to seek to minimise the effect of those cuts. But I think you've got to look at a couple of things. The first thing is that there is £10 million every year going into this budget, this council budget, which I didn't approve because I thought it was very badly handled. £10 million a year is going in to a third layer of contingency funds for actual projects. This is not the money that we have to keep back in case there's a flood or in case there's something else, dreadful that happens, or an epidemic, or the harbour drains or something stupid like that. That's covered. We've got all that there. We're not touching that. But there's £10 million that this administration has put in every year as extra money. Now, that money's not been used in the past, and I think it's very unlikely it will be used again. That money could be used to do these things. And do you know what? That money's actually been borrowed at with interest rates. It's been borrowed to put into a chest somewhere that can be used at some stage, possibly at a time of another election. You know, it's. These sorts of things are very concerning. This is not the way I want the city to move forward.
Now, some have compared the shutdown of the libraries to book burning.
Well, I've led the charge about the libraries. I chair the Libraries Task and Finish Group, and before that, on the Neighbourhood Scrutiny Group, we actually kept the administration to the feet to the fire on that. But the worrying thing is that what we've proposed, what the consultation, the majority of people in the consultation said none of the above, what the Task and Finish Group then proposed, and what full council actually agreed to as a motion that I led, which was to find a way of mutualizing the whole library system, has been ignored. What we're going to end up by doing, I suspect, is mutualizing just the bit that was originally going to be kept in the first place. So this becomes rather difficult to understand why, when there's no money involved in this, why this administration is hell-bent on doing what it already decided and not listening to what people and councillors have to say about how we might do it a different way that would spread it out for the whole of the city, rather than just keep these 10 libraries, which is very sad.
Now, I know you've got to go in a minute, Anthony, but I can't resist asking you about the Salisbury Skripal case, because North Somerset MP Jacob Rees-Mogg has been calling for tough Russian sanctions as a result. What are your thoughts about whether we've actually proven that Russia was behind this attack?
I am somebody that actually puts a lot of faith in analysis and information. I do think that it is conceivable that there are other ways that this could have happened. I agree with the majority of people that say it's extremely unlikely. The most credible solution is the one that everyone seems to have fixed upon. But I do think there are possibly other ways out there that this may have happened by other agencies, it's a shame that we rushed to judgment immediately. But in terms of the what we've done, I think the 23 diplomats is the biggest thing we've done in this country for a very, very long time, since I believe the Cold War. There's a lot of pressure, and I think Mr. Rees-Mogg is one of them, that want to do even more and more. I think, again, I go back to what I said earlier. I think we have to be positive. Do you honestly believe, or does anyone honestly believe, that the way this is going to get better better is by falling out with people and stopping talking to them and stopping keeping relationships going in any way at all. That's not the way that we actually move forward into a rather more positive working arrangement. And I think if we are going to long term solve these sorts of problems, we have to be thinking ourselves as a community of nations that has to somehow keep talking to each other. And I personally would not want a greater escalation of what's happening, because I think we'll get more done by keeping talking than we will by just tit-for-tat sanctions. And I think that's very unhelpful.
Well, Lib Dem, Councillor for Cotton, Anthony Negus, thanks very much for joining us on the Politics Show. And I'll ask you a similar question, Martin, about Salisbury.
Well, obviously, I would probably be in the minority of those that believe that it's most unlikely that the Russians would have done this, and that there are far more likely explanations related to the behaviour of Western intelligence services. But then I'm a bit of an expert on the Western intelligence services and the kind of things they've done in the past. For example, as I mentioned last week, the six people that died after the anthrax attacks in the US following 9/11, there was an investigation carried out there, and there's beyond dispute that the anthrax used in those attacks came from Fort Detrick in Maryland, the US equivalent of Porton Down. Nobody's been punished. They should have been, but nobody's been punished. Now, if you've got an intelligence service like the CIA, which gets away with stuff like that, killing six people, freaking everybody out, frightening everybody, it definitely came from inside their equivalent of Porton Down. Nobody's punished. I would say it's quite likely they're going to try that sort of trick on again. So it won't necessarily be the MI6 that's done this. It could be the CIA. It could be the SBU from Ukraine. It could be Mossad. There's all sorts of possibilities. I think the most likely explanation is that the Novichok or whatever it is came from inside Porton Down. Although, of course, since we haven't seen the British have only just recently released what they've got of what they claim to have found, we don't really know. I mean, and also the other important thing is they've not followed any procedure here. They've just in the space of 24 hours they made up their mind what happened. They apportioned the blame, and that was the end of it. And I just don't believe that you can resolve a complex case like that in that sort of time frame.
Well, also, another story this week is that a guy called Paul, who had a plaque put up to him in the bear pit, the city council have taken that down. It was only a few months ago. He was a homeless chap who was very much loved by many people who were around there. But contractors working for or the city council themselves have unscrewed it and taken it away. This is part of a bit of a dispute that's been going on, Martin, now. I mean, originally, George Ferguson brought in the Bear Pit Improvement Group, the idea being to make the place a nicer place to kind of walk through, with a bit of street art, a few people selling teas and coffees, maybe that sort of thing. What do you make of this falling out? Because effectively the traders who've been there have said that we don't want any more of these street artists or homeless people here, just get rid of them. And the council have agreed. And then they've now been the Bear Pit Improvement Group, which is a group connected with Stokes Croft, People's Republic of Stokescroft, have now been told, out you go.
Well, I mean, this is not really the sort of thing of which I have a very strong knowledge, but I would say that, over the years, the Bear Pit has definitely improved, partly through the street art and partly through the fact that they've got, small businesses operating down there. When I first came to Bristol, 20 years ago, it was basically just a place where the sort of homeless and alcoholic people used to hang out, and it was a space for them, but it wasn't a space for anybody else.
But there's been a lot of discussion about it in the press, particularly in the Bristol Post and in Bristol 24/7, and I was really pretty shocked with 24/7, which was initially started up by a friend of mine and then taken over by the people who used to run the venue, and they had an article about it where they interviewed PRSC, People's Republic of Stokescroft, Chris Chalkley, who's one of the main people behind the getting the street art and getting the homeless people into the Bear Pit, in a sort of at least finding places for them there and transforming the place. A tremendous amount of hours he spent down there doing this stuff, and he wasn't even quoted in the article, so they interviewed him but then ignored him on Bristol 24/7. I think that's an appalling bit of journalism, so let's just have a bit of both sides. But anyway, I tracked down Chris Chalkley earlier on this week and spoke to him about the Bear Pit and what's been happening down there.
My name's Chris Chalkley. I'm from the People's Republic of Stokescroft.
And you're involved in the Bear Pit. In fact, you were one of the people who was instrumental in transforming the place.
Yeah, we founded it about 7 years ago.
Was it a Bear Pit Improvement Group?
Yes, it was a CIC was formed called the Bear Pit Improvement Group.
Well, I think most people would agree that it's been improvement. I mean, it certainly looks better. But you've had problems recently, haven't you?
Yeah, no, we've been working for the last 7 years to improve the space, and I think in many ways it's improved beyond recognition. Recently there has been a campaign to discredit the extraordinary work that has been done, and this is related to a schism that took place between traders and the original group.
I mean, do you think it was a mistake to bring traders in? Because it isn't necessarily compatible having some homeless people, some sort of street artists in with traders.
I think we have to decide what that space is all about, really. What is interesting about it is it sits cheek by jowl with the biggest corporate trading area in the city, Broadmead, and then of course Cabot Circus. And since the 1960s, it's been an oasis for alternative culture in many ways. And that was the premise. The whole premise when we started the Bear Pit Improvement Group is that this could be an exemplar of genuine community to work with what was already there.
So, is the vision for a sort of open air exhibition space with a few places to buy fruit and vegetable, have a cup of tea?
I think that the vision, at least from my point of view, was that this was a place of genuine experiment, and the commercialization of it has proven to be problematic.
Is the experiment over now?
No, for me, absolutely not. I think that what we are doing, what has been going on in Stokescroft and is the heart of what's going on in Bristol, is a genuine debate about where we want our society to go. And we see from corporate Bristol the development of business improvement districts. We have showers underneath some businesses so that if anybody decides to sleep there, they will be covered with showers of water. We've seen the head of Destination Bristol suggest that homeless people should be moved on from business improvement districts in case terrorist bombs might be hidden underneath their blankets. There is a demonization of the most vulnerable going on in this city. And, you know, I'm long in the tooth, and I can remember 40 years ago, there were no street people. There was no homeless scenario. This is a direct product of government policy.
So whereabouts are the artists, the people that used to be in the Bear Pit, whereabouts are they going to move to?
Well, that's the problem. You know, if you're going to move the street, where do the street people move to? If we don't actually address the problems of homelessness, of addiction here, and become... Actually, Bristol's future really should be about being an example of how we might do these things better. And the suggestion that we should just attempt to move it on and sanitise certain areas is disastrous.
I mean, do you think the council could have had some sort of compromise which would retain some of the presence in the Bear Pit as well as the businesses? I mean, was there a really serious problem, do you think?
The problems of the Bear Pit are overstated. It is not the most criminalised. It isn't the place where the most crime takes place in the city.
Some would say maybe that's corporate boardrooms.
Yes, maybe that. Maybe, yes. What I actually think is that what has happened is Bristol City Council has removed the licence from the community enterprise. And I think what we as a city now need to do, and in particular relationship to that space, is we need to really plan what we do next. And my view is that we can create a genuine... I think the situation with the traders who have been there for that period is one that is at best murky. My understanding is that no rent has been paid for the last 18 months. There is an element of favouritism, it would seem, amongst certain councillors and certain council officers. And I think there has been a demonisation of certain community groups. And I think this all has to come out in the wash. This is a public space, and the street people were here before the traders. and the graffiti artists too. And I think we should be looking at what we really do to create an extraordinary exemplar in the center of our city.
Your improvement group has been removed, but there's no way really to remove the street artists. They'll be down there at night time, or the homeless.
Exactly, exactly. So we have to work. One of the central tenets of PRSC's philosophy is that you work with the grain of the wood. So, you know, if we're going to have any enterprises down there, perhaps we should be having enterprises that are related to the homeless scenario. So perhaps we have Bristol Drugs Project involved down there. Perhaps we have St. Mungo's involved down there. And we have food offerings that are ones that are sympathetic to the needs of the people who are already there.
Are there soup runs and things like that happening there?
It's a very interesting thing about that is that soup runs used to occur a lot in the Bear Pit. It was a known place for that. And over the last 7 years, those activities have been pushed out of the Bear Pit, which is antithetical to what you would think ought to happen.
It's interesting. Maybe the council will crunch on this a bit more anyway. Thanks, Chris Chalkley, for joining us.
And Martin, I hope that's enlightened you a little bit on what's been going on at the Bear Pit. But it does seem to me the traders are the only people that matter to the City Council. The idea that homeless people and artists might want to use the space seems to be out the window, which is strange because, as Chris said there, apparently they're not paying rent.
Well, yeah, and I would argue that the People's Republic of Stokes Croft created the atmosphere in which the traders can operate. Before they were in there, the place really was a place which the homeless had made their own, and they wouldn't the traders wouldn't be operating there at all if there hadn't been some attempt to upgrade the area. But now, of course, having like cuckoos in the nest, they're now saying that they want the whole show for themselves. It's always been a problematic space, and I do appreciate that Chris Chalkley and the people at PSRC have, as was just pointed out,
PRSC
are trying to experiment with, using city space in a different kind of way. And it's a shame that the council are under pressure from commercial interests, really, to, basically make the whole place. I don't think it'll work as a commercial place, frankly. It's not really the right sort of space for a successful commercial, purely commercial activity to go on. Lots of people now they've put in the pedestrian crossings and things around it. Many people won't go under there who unless they've got some kind of alternative interest.
Why is a so-called Labour council much more interested in trying to get money, even though it's not getting any money, than it is in the homeless and artists?
It may very well be that the commercial lobby is lobbying the officers, and that the council itself is just being lackadaisical about it and not seeing it as an area to be developed in an alternative way. I don't know enough about it other than to say that. But I think in many ways it's been a success down there, and it's a shame that all this squabbling is undermining what's been achieved.
Yeah, and also I think it's really important the people like Bristol 24/7 actually take an even hand in it. It just seems to me that with so much of the press here, apart possibly from the BBC, the Post and, Bristol 24/7 taking a really partisan view. This is a little story that they have decided that they're just going to shut out some of the main people in the debate and put out a completely biased, half-baked report on it.
Well, I think the pressure of commercial interests is overwhelming and relentless in most spheres of life. And, the council officer who is saying that the homeless might be hiding bombs in their belongings, that just strikes me. Frankly, he should have been reprimanded for that, and if I was in charge, I'd have sacked him.
Also, another event. We've got an event next week going on in the Malcolm X Centre up in St Paul's, which is all about looking at the future for the black community in the city. Now, Carnival's back this year, Martin.
Good. I'm pleased.
Why has it not been happening for such a long time?
I mean, I think, as far as I understand it, the police have always complained about it because there's always a modicum of trouble, and the police feel that their budget is stretched, and that they're basically the same thing happened. They do it quite a lot. They want whoever's organising it to pay for the policing. And of course, the organisers can't really afford to do that, and that then snarls it all up.
Anyway, 7 o'clock next Wednesday evening at the Malcolm X Centre. Former leader from the 1980s, who we interviewed on this programme back at the end of last year, I think it was November last year, Nana Kweku Engerman, who used to be known as Balagoon, is going to be giving a talk in the Malcolm X Centre about what he sees as what was really going on back in the 1980s, but also looking at the future, particularly for the black community here in Bristol.
I'm Nana Kweku Engerman, formerly known as Rascal and Mujahid Balagoon, and on the 28th of March, it's a commemorative meeting. It's 38 years since the uprising in St. Paul's on the 2nd of April, which was actually the first uprisings of its type, and all the other big cities and towns followed suit after.
But you call it an uprising, but most people surely call it a riot.
Yeah, but that's up to them. I can't be expected to say what they say.
So why do you characterise it as an uprising rather than a riot?
Because that's what it was. It was an uprising against the system of racism, of institutionalised racism, because, you know, at that time, black people, they weren't living in the best conditions. The education system was failing black people. Young black youth, especially the boys, were being criminalised for no apparent reason apart from being black. And so much things were against us. You couldn't get credit if you lived in St. Paul's because the area had been stigmatised. You know, you were being stopped and searched because you were being black. And this was like 5 or 6 or even 7 times more likely to happen to young black youth than to our white counterparts. And so there was an uprising about all these issues. We didn't have anywhere to go. You know, we couldn't get jobs. We couldn't get employed. You know, there was nowhere to go. So it was an uprising. It wasn't a riot. It was an uprising. Bristol has been fortunate, and the whole of the country, I guess, has been fortunate not to ever experience a riot. Certainly not a riot that has come emanated from the black communities.
Yeah, you're talking about what happened then, but you know, part of this talk is you're outlining a future for the black community.
The fundamentals of the way forward is all about self-help. It's all about getting up and doing things for yourself, because we've pointed the finger long enough. Of course, there is still a need to point the finger. I mean, you just have a look at what's happened in Bath at the Beech and Cliff School, where 7 white boys have tied 1 black boy to a lamppost and whipped him and taken part in a mock auction. Clearly, racism still prevails very strongly, and it's coming from the home. Those boys, how old are they, you know, to be doing something like that? So clearly they're influenced from the homes, and it clearly demonstrates that, you know, within the homes of white people, there is a serious racial bias towards black people.
Well, you're talking about housing and jobs problems back in the 1980s. I mean, surely those problems are still there. They haven't gone away at all.
No, they haven't. None of the issues have gone away. We're still being excluded from school at the drop of the hat. I made mention of this issue in Bath. Those boys who have tied the black boy up and whipped him, they're still at school. They've not been expelled, they've not been excluded. But, you know, a black child who, let's say, for example, because the common one they say is that the black child has come in and his clothes smells of smoke. Immediately, that's expulsion. But for a white child that whips a black child having tied him up, you know, the school governors say we can't expel them. So,
but what, you know, aren't most of these issues? Aren't most of these issues related to poverty, the same sort of problems in Hartcliffe as there are in St. Paul's?
No, tomorrow. We're talking about racism here. You can't equate institutionalized racism to poverty. Yeah, you can't do that. I don't think we should try to go down that road. Of course, there is an issue of poverty that needs to be addressed. If you can't get a job, certain other institutions are failing you, of course there's an issue of poverty. But let's not try to cancel it out by saying people in Hartcliffe are impoverished, because they're not facing a system that is inherently racist, that is geared towards them, and in every little move they make, the institution steps in front of them to prevent them from making progress based on the colour of their skin. That's what institutionalised racism is all about.
I mean, is this aimed at black people, white people, or...?
Obviously, the primary focus, without apology, is black people. But there are good white people in society, and we want to hold hands with them to move progressively forward. We don't intend to alienate anyone at all. Everyone should attend, whether you're black or white or whatever your colour you are, whatever... you know, your culture, everyone has a right to attend that meeting, and everyone will be welcome to attend that meeting. We won't be saying, oh, you can't attend because you're not black and this is just for black people. It's just as important for white people to attend that meeting as it is for black people to attend the meeting.
Where and when is it taking place?
Well, this meeting will take place at the Malcolm X Centre, which is in the heart of St. Paul's. And it's on the 28th of March, and it'll start about 7:30 in the evening.
Okay,
it's a Wednesday.
That's a Wednesday evening. Okay, Nana, thanks very much for talking to us.
Thank you very much, Tony.
Well, that was an interesting contribution there. And as you said, it's open to anybody to go to this meeting, although obviously the main focus is to the black community to self assess its
One of the interesting
situation.
Things you're saying there, Martin, is that actually the uprising in St. Paul's was the first. It really led the trend against Thatcherism.
I remember the weekend very well because I was living in Brixton at the time and we were the second. Not that I participated, but I definitely witnessed the uprising in Brixton, and it was an uprising because the police had been incredibly bullying in the previous months and weeks leading up to what happened in Brixton. But of course, when it kicked off in Bristol, and then of course in Liverpool was the other big one. It was a turning point, and the Scarman report by a white judge into what happened in Brixton concluded that the police were largely responsible for the mess because of their racist attitudes.
So that
was a justification for those that that took to the streets. Although, of course, these things are never unproblematic.
This meeting is about the black community specifically, but what about actually quite a lot of similarities in a way between the sorts of issues and problems caused by poverty in St. Paul's and Hartcliffe?
Well, I think the fact of the matter is, I mean, and I remember the Brixton riot particularly because I was there. I was only in my 20s, is that the majority of the participants were black, but it was a significant minority that weren't, and there was a general hostility towards the police because the police were regarded as a largely oppressive and bullying force, and at that time they were. Of course, modern policing is much more professional than it was in those days. It was the policing of Brixton was completely unprofessional, and a lot of the problems were created by young white police officers who'd voted Tory and had an attitude problem.
Nana there mentioned this mock slave auction over in Bath. The school, it seems, is being protected by the establishment because certainly online, we've just named it, he's just named it, but apparently online you're not allowed to name the school. And they're caught talking about it just as allegations. The children who were supposed to be behind this mock slave auction were apparently suspended from school for a couple of days and are now back at school. The seven white teenagers apparently chained up and whipped a black classmate, calling him extremely racist names, harking back to the slave trade era.
Well, I mean, we've got to be careful about this. I don't know anything about this, so I don't know what to say about it. But if it's true, then it's obviously absolutely reprehensible.
I mean, why can't we say where the score was?
Well,
and,
I don't
and
know.
Repeat.
I don't,
there the, seems to be, this is the first seems I've to heard be, Martin, it, that you should be able to at least say that there are allegations that this took place, where it took place, and what those allegations are. Unless there is a court case against those specific individuals, which would then stop reporting. And yet it seems that there's a blanket ban on reporting of this story.
There obviously is some reporting of it, because we're talking about it now. Somebody must have told somebody about this incident, otherwise we wouldn't be talking about it. But obviously I don't know much about it. It's the first I've heard of it.
I mean, it bears out what Nana was saying there, that the establishment closes ranks still to this day around these racist incidents.
Well, of course they do. And in actual fact, given the austerity policies that have been pursued in this country since the financial crash, poor people are probably worse off than they were in the 1980s when there was still a functioning welfare state and all the rest of it. And council housing was still available to people on low incomes. So, I mean, the idea that things have improved is for the birds, really.
Mr. Speaker, 500,000 businesses will see their rates rise this year, some by 500%. Even Mary Portas, who led the government's Save the High Street campaign, said it was simply a PR campaign which looked like, hey, we're doing something, and hoped it might kickstart something. But it didn't. Mr. Speaker, this Conservative government has slashed public services. They cut funding and expect councils to pick up the pieces. Yeah. The result of this is children's centres are closing, yeah, schools are struggling, yeah, fewer police on the streets, yeah, older people being left without care or dignity, and refugees turning women away. The Tories' own head of local government says it's unsustainable. And doesn't it tell you everything you need to know? Doesn't it tell you everything you need to know about this government, that it demands households and businesses pay more to get less?
This government is spending more on our schools and our NHS than ever before. Do that because of the balanced approach we take to our economy and because of the strong economy we see under the Conservatives. But I notice that the Right Honourable Gentleman in his six questions has not mentioned today's unemployment figures. Employment is at a joint record high. Unemployment hasn't been lower since 1975. Economic inactivity is at a record low. That's a strong jobs market. Who do I think benefits from a strong jobs market? Labour staffers, Labour council leaders, and moderate Labour members of Parliament.
Well, I mean, the fact that she mentions 1975, that's actually, I'm old enough to remember when unemployment went over a million in 1973, and it's never been down below a million in the previous decades. And of course, the employment that's been created is zero-hours contracts employment, subsidised by universal credit now, and previously subsidised by tax credits. And of course, it's all based on zero interest rates and quantitative easing.
Sucking all the money out of society?
Well, we've created a situation where the fire insurance and real estate sector is a parasite on the rest of the economy.
Time for the Murdoch News at 7. That's Martin Summers. Thanks to our guest. He was the councillor for Knowle, Anthony Negus. I'll see you after the news.
Winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.